Okay, thank you very much. So this is a little bit different from the two talks that you heard this morning. It's very theoretical, so I apologize for those of you who are more interested in theory. And more importantly, it's actually quite chemical. So this talk and the next one are going to be the two chemical talks of the day. Okay, so first of all, let me list really the two main questions that I will very broadly cover in this talk. So the first one is really whether we can establish how the initial physical and chemical conditions of the gas that may be forming stars. So I'm talking about dense gas here. So I'm kind of moving away from the, let's say, diffuse gas that we talked about this morning. And the key question there is how the initial physical and chemical condition of this gas may affect the chemistry of the type of gas that eventually will form stars. And the second question, which is really just related, so maybe it could be included into really into the first one, is we know that one way or another, you need to go from very diffuse gas into clumps, cores, filaments, whatever, that may eventually form stars. And so you have to go from very diffuse to dense somehow. And there isn't just one way of going there. Of course, there is a free-fall way, gravity, of course. But that's not the only way, or at least it's not the only ingredient during the collapse of gas into dense gas. And so one question that we kind of toyed with and we investigated recently is how important for the actual chemistry of the dense gas is the way you get to the dense gas. And so these are kind of the two questions that I'm going to toy with during this talk. Okay, so there have been many, many papers by many authors in this audience as well. We have been investigating the transition from atomic to molecular gas, not just talking about H2H2. I'm also talking about the transition between carbon plus or C2, depending on the community, to carbon, neutral carbon and molecular carbon, so CO. And so I shall not really talk about that here because others will in the next couple of days. And of course, these transitions will depend on several parameters, but more or less, we know that they occur at relatively low visual extinctions. So what I decided to concentrate on this talk is instead to look into deeper into your cloud or into your gas. So things that happen and that are important at higher visual extinctions, so certainly above what I call the critical visual extinction, although that's also debatable, but about, you know, from three magnitude onwards. And that's really the regime where, unless you have extremely strong UV fluxes, the radiation field doesn't necessarily penetrate. And there are several factors that may influence the gas at higher visual extinctions, and I've listed some here. And I shall not really cover them all, but obviously, these are few of the most important factors that will affect it. For example, the H2H2 region, sorry, the H2H2 transition, although I won't talk about it here, do not think that it only affects the edge of the skin of a cloud. It will affect also what happens deeper because, you know, the chemistry is, of course, driven by this relationship. But really what I will at least talk about to start with is what I put in quotes into the dynamics. So I put it into quotes because for those of you who do dynamical model, I'm not going to talk about any dynamics at all. For those of us who do chemical models, we sometimes approximate the dynamics with some toy approximations. And so that's why I put dynamics into quotes to show how the mimicking of dynamics can affect the chemistry of the gas. The parameters that I list here and many more are not, of course, independent parameters, as we shall see later. And I'll show later how one could tackle the intricate connection between all these parameters. But to start with, I'm going to have a look at them kind of individually. So again, I underline this is really a theoretical exercise, which is very difficult to compare directly with observations, which is also a word of warning for those of you who use just template models to compare with observations. Often these template models concentrate on one parameter without investigating the rest. So in terms of images, these are the only two images that I've got in this talk, I'm afraid. So I'm not going to deal with this. I'm going to mainly deal with this, so the dark patches that you see in the sky. Okay. All right, so we started toying with the idea of looking into, as I said, dynamics in quotes a long time ago, where we really wondered whether we could have a unified picture. So we wrote this paper, which had this grand title of On the Origin of Diffuse Clouds. And as you can imagine, we did not solve the problem of the origin of diffuse clouds, but the idea that we were toying with was whether you could have two different types of diffuse gas, to do with the fact that maybe the cycle of gas is continuous, and so maybe diffuse clouds are not just a different, completely different type of gas from, say, translucent or dense gas, but it's simply an issue of time. As I said, we toyed with this idea. We didn't manage to conclude much, as you'll see, but basically the idea being that you may come from intercloud gas, so I'm talking about gas which is much less dense than diffuse clouds, so say 10 centimeter cube, and you could go, you know, you go this way where you kind of contract a bit through turbulence, MHD, and get diffuse gas where diffuse means something like 100 or 300 per centimeter cube, which are the typical gas densities that we see in our two prototypes of diffuse clouds, zeta off and zeta per, in our own galaxy. And then, you know, some of this gas will contract further, form dark clouds, which eventually, apart from the clumps that will form stars, will expand again, and that's a different version of diffuse gas. And so we did some, as I said, theoretical chemical modeling of these two different phases. So these are just a bunch of curves of fractional abundances of several molecules and atoms as a function of time. And this is the contraction phase, so the one that goes this way. And then we did the same for the other way. And we were hoping to find some very significant differences. Again, these are just a bunch of curves, and it's difficult to visualize, but just take me at face value when I say that there weren't that many differences. I mean, there were factors. But when you're dealing with factors, obviously that's not really very convincing. And of course, then, when even comparing with observations, there were two issues. So here is observations of zeta per, which is at about 100 per centimeter cube, and this observation of zeta off, which is about 300 per centimeter cube. Now, this model is old. There are newer models which match the observations better. But the bottom line was that not only we weren't really able to match most of the observations with either collapse or expansion phase, but more importantly, although there were some differences in species, which really was what we were looking for, they weren't significant enough, certainly not from the molecular point of view, which is really what we wanted to look at, to convince us to go any further, really, on this model. Nevertheless, yeah. Yeah, so, well, what we had, again, very qualitatively, because this was a chemical model, the idea we never got to a very dense state, right? So we were a state of a dark molecular cloud. So we're just thinking with time, you may, of course, you need some pressure of some sort, right? Temperature increasing, maybe the UV radiation penetrating and eventually expanding. So we didn't, we weren't advocating necessarily a source for this expansion. We were looking to see whether chemically was possible to differentiate between those two phases. So let's see, this is the time scale for expansion, but I don't remember how we determined it, okay? So too long ago, 13 years ago, so. So, but yes, this is the time. So we determined that we had an equation for expansion. I don't remember exactly what went into it. So there were some differences, right? So for example, but it was only a few factors. There were very few molecules that you could differentiate for more than one order of magnitude. So we thought, okay, years later, so kind of now, we decided instead to maybe zoom in a little bit and to look a little bit better at the mode of collapse that we are considering. So now I'm moving into, so although I said, you know, this is still a regime where you are kind of almost below the critical visual magnitude, certainly for the diffuse phase. So we're now really moving deeper into the cloud. And the second dynamics topic that I wanted to cover is this. So this is work in preparation. So it's a series by a student, Felix Priestley, student at UCL. So what we did here was the following. As you all know better than me, coupling dynamical models with complex chemistry is difficult, it's time consuming. It can be done, but it's difficult to really explore large parameter spaces when you couple the two. So what we did here, we were trying to see, A, whether we could parameterize some numerical models, some dynamical models, to put into our chemical models, and B, whether we could then differentiate the different modes of potential collapse of a clamp through chemistry. So what we did here, without favoring any type of mode of collapse, we considered five different numerical models that we found, dynamical models that we found. One was the standard Larsen kind of constant density collapse. The second and the third are to do with basically collapse from an unstable sphere of gas, so Bonhoeffer sphere. The first one, which is called BES1, was slightly unstable. It was just a change by 1.1 in density, while the second one, if I remember correctly, was a factor of 4 density increased in order to get it out of equilibrium. And the fourth was a collapse mode where it was basically balanced, partly balanced by magnetic support, so magnetic fields were included. And you know, as you all know, magnetic fields are important in star formation because they can delay the collapse due to gravity. But if the ionization fraction is low, then neutrals and ions can decouple. The neutrals can then drift away from the ions which are coupled with the magnetic fields, and they can follow the gravitational potential. So in the fifth model, we include, and this is the so-called ambipolar diffusion model, and so we included that in the fifth. And of course, then we also did the standard free-fall collapse for comparison. And then for each of these, let's call them dynamical model, we varied a bunch of parameters, and this is just a section, a bunch of parameters in the chemical models, that is, and ignore this because we're going to the microphysics, which we've done enough last week, so we don't want to really, not this week, we don't really want to talk about it. But basically, maybe what I will point out is the variation in the cosmic ionization rate, which may or may not give you some differences. Okay, so the first thing that I wanted to show you is, so this is the evolution of the central density, okay? So the model is multipoints, but here is just the evolution of the central density for CO, and so that's the radius from the center. For all the different models, again, sorry, a lot of acronyms, but I'll try to, I think every slide has got this acronym listed on the top. And as you can see, you know, there is a difference. This is a time evolution in time for CO. So even forgetting the actual abundance itself, which depends on all sorts of other things, of course, but there is a difference across models. So starting, so this is all the same model with just different recipes for how the collapse is occurring. And I think things that I wanted to point out is that if you take the, so there's kind of almost a separation between the stable models and then not so stable models. Okay, so there is a separation between the constant density the constant densities, the very unstable Bang hemisphere, and the free fall are what I call the unstable in the sense that there is no support there, so gravity takes over, while the other three, there is a little bit, well, certainly these two, there is more support due to the magnetic field. Always 10 Kelvin, sorry, I forgot to say. So there is no excitation effects here. That's the temperature is always cold. Yes, there is. Yes, yeah. So there, sorry, I did not mention anything about the details of the chemical model. Okay, so you can ask me later, but it's a gas grain time-dependent chemical model, which includes a fairly comprehensive set of certainly all the gas phase reactions, but also a fairly comprehensive set of surface reactions. And non-thermal evaporation is included. In fact, those three parameters that you saw at the here, this, are all to do with the non-thermal desorptions and the different efficiency of a different type of non-thermal desorption, but I'm just ignoring it for now.
Yeah. No.
This is just the cold phase, so I'm not. I don't get to the star effectively. There's no switch on. Absolutely not. So it's important what's in on the dust. So there's a gas grain in the sense that the atoms and molecules freeze onto the dust grain, and it's important what you're forming because you've got this non-thermal desorption. But there is no thermal evaporation due to any increase in temperature. So temperature is constant at 10 Kelvin. Okay. So as I said, because of kind of a division between the different models, we decided that we wanted to, well, look at the, well, we did several studies on sensitivities, but the one I'm showing here had to do with how the speed of collapse may affect the chemistry, and then on the other hand, how magnetic fields incorporated in the last two models may affect the chemistry. Okay, so do we have differences? That's a key point. So remember, these are very, we're talking about quality. I'm never comparing with observation deliberately here, okay, because those are not models that can be directly related to observations. I'm looking for differences that you may eventually find in observations. Okay, so here we're looking at these three different models. So we are effectively looking at the effects of the speed of collapse. At the time when I looked at this, so this is ammonia, fractional abundance as a function of distance, and so this is a snapshot quite late in time, but it's a function of space. And really, when I looked at that and I thought in terms of single dish observations, you would agree with me that there isn't that much difference. However, if you take Taurus or Orion, or whatever, at a distance or whatever they are, so close by, in fact, the resolution of ALMA could actually resolve you this quite a lot. So, you know, here you're talking about an order of magnitude. Unfortunately, it's ammonia, so you can't observe it. But, you know, you start having some differences which may be appreciable with interferometers, okay? But certainly not with single dish. So this dunk a few years ago would have told you, nah, you're not really gonna find a difference. Other species have even less appreciable effects, like CS, for example. I think you would agree with me that there isn't much difference there, especially at those low fractional abundances. C2H instead is an interesting molecule because, in fact, not only there are differences, but for those of us interested in the trends, you agree that there is actually different trends in how it behaves as a function of space. I'm going to speed up a bit because I've just looked at the time. Okay, so HCO plus again. Interesting that you can get an order of magnitude difference because HCO plus is a very difficult ion to make in cold environments, and yet it's observed. So it's interesting that you can actually, by changing this, get it a variation by an order of magnitude. So I'm going to speed up here. Okay, the presence of magnetic fields, at least for this type of models, didn't really seem to produce a huge difference, not as much as I was expecting or was hoping to find. Okay, so again, you have some species like C3H2 that, if observed at high enough spatial resolution, you may find some differences. Okay, so here is where we coupled, basically, we took just one model. This was the AD models and the BES model. So this is the one with ambipolar diffusion and instead the one just with the relatively stable Bang hemisphere. And then we varied the radiation field. So we went from 1 to 10. in cosmic ionization rate to see whether we found a difference. There is a, you know, there are some differences, but they're not huge. But Cecilia will talk about ionization later, so I'm gonna keep moving from here. Okay, so we then looked at something different. We went again a little bit looking at the actual initial conditions, so we said, okay, so there we were changing the so-called dynamics. Let's change a little bit more, not just the dynamics, but actually the chemistry here, okay? So let me spend a couple of minutes explaining this. So this is fractional abundances as a function, not of time, not of space, but of the different models that we ran, okay? So they're just marks here, okay? These are all the different models. So what we did here is we said, well, a lot of these chemical models that you see, again, the templates that you see a snapshot in time, but you don't know at what density they're starting their calculations. Most often, the density that they start with is already relatively dense. And for relatively dense, I'm talking about 100 per centimeter cube. You're already in a situation where some atoms are locked in molecules, and yet the models start from purely atomic, and then they just give this density, and then they increase the density. So I wanted to see whether by varying the initial density from 10 to 100, reaching the same final density, same model, same network, same everything, you would make a difference. And the interesting thing here is that, so for example, if you take one and two together, and three and four and five and six, and ignore the seventh for a moment. So if you see that, if you look at CO, it makes no difference whatsoever. That's good, right? It means that, you know, ultimately CO forms, regardless of the initial density, you know, it reaches some sort of equilibrium. If you know three's out, it reaches equilibrium. However, it's interesting to see that a very small change, sorry, let me talk also about the other models that I've done first. So I also changed the initial elemental abundances. Already in our own galaxy, we know that in some cases it might, you know, maybe the gas is solar, most people do use solar abundances, but if you look at clouds like TMC1 or HEL134N, you find different compositions or different elemental abundances for carbon and oxygen. They change by a factor of maybe two or three, okay? But remember, carbon and oxygen are the most abundant elements, okay? So when you look at CO across, you see no difference, right? These are no appreciable difference observationally. But when you translate these differences in molecules which are much less abundant, okay? If you consider N2H+, or more importantly, HC3N, okay? Look at the differences it makes, okay? You're going from 10 to minus 11 to almost 10 to minus 7 when CO hardly changes. And you might say, well, okay, but who cares about HC3N? Well, some do. They use HC3N over N2H+ as a ratio, as an age indicator for pre-stellar cores, okay? So then, if you do that, you need to care about this, okay? So again, just initial conditions are important. This is observed, right? So for example, in these studies, we observed, we looked at several clouds here. I'm just showing you the results from NGC 2071, just a cloud where we looked at, we mapped the CO, the isotopologous of CO, so we were optically thin, and we studied the depletion factor, basically, okay? So basically what you're seeing here is the ratio between the H2 measured from dust measurement and H2 measured from C18O, okay? And the ratio, it's one way of measuring the depletion. For depletion, I'm not talking about the depletion we were talking about in the first two talks. This is depletion of how much CO freezes on the dust, okay? So that's my depletion. Probably depletion is not the right word. Anyway, as you can see, even within the same cloud, you have several different values for it due to whether they're starless or pre-stellar core or protostellar cores, but even within starless cores, you have different depletion factors. So keep that in mind when you then use different type of molecules to get an idea about the age of your core. Okay, so basically the conclusion here is that small variations in the abundance of abundant molecules gives you large variations in the abundance of tracer molecules, which might sound obvious, but is often ignored. So how do we deal with it? So do we just go home and forget about the chemistry? Well, obviously we don't want to do that. So one way of dealing with this is to try to statistically approach the problem, is to accept that there are many parameters that affect the chemistry, And so embrace the fact that you have to deal with these many parameters and see whether you can find a statistical approach to get some insights about all these parameters put together. So we kind of put together a kind of a suite of statistical tools to deal with the interpretation of chemical models. And here I'm just going to really I'll advertise these tools really rather than anything else. So one of the tools we use is hierarchical clustering. The nice thing of this method is that you do not have to define the a priori the clusters. For clusters is all the models basically that you can cluster together in terms of that gives you similar output. And of course you have to define what you mean for similar, and you may have different definitions depending on what you're interested on. But basically each of these each of the leaves of this dendrogram represent one model. Okay, so these were millions of models were run. And the different clusters are indicated by a different color. A nicer way is to use what is called probabilistic hierarchical clustering. And here, the advantage is something that for us is very important, is that in the previous one, in the hierarchical clustering, the time series of your chemical models, they all have to be the same, right? So you cannot start from different initial densities, because otherwise then, once you have to get to the same final density, the time that it takes is different. And that is not okay for hierarchical clustering, but it's okay for probabilistic hierarchical clustering. So it's got that advantage. Let me move quick here, so this is just a dendrogram from the hierarchical clustering. The other thing that we use, the other tool that we use, is so-called accelerated Bayesian inference. And this is just a particular example where we're looking at how whether we could determine how the ices that we observe where where they were coming from, all the different parameters that determine what's on the icy mantles of pre-stellar cores. And so again, I won't go into the results, but we could actually run many, many, many models and remove the degeneracies using this approach. And again, I wanted to put this slide in because of the conversations that we had in the last few days about grain growth and what forms on the icy mantles, and the fact that I remember Nick saying that we should just forget all the experiments because they're not representing what the ISM does, et cetera, et cetera. You don't remember, but I remember. You remember. Okay. So then what we did, So what we did, then here was to say, well, it's true that every experiment, it takes 2 or 3 years to make. There are millions of experiments you can make for every one reaction depending on, or every one set of species depending on the conditions. Can we help the experimentalist can we help them effectively to just prioritize specific experiments? And so again, we did this Bayesian uncertainty analysis, and we came up with the fact, so we just took a small network, it was a proof of concept. We just looked at 23 reactions, and out of these 23, we could remove 8, which effectively just are not important for that parameter space that we were considering. And so in a sense, if you can imagine this method applied to the whole network, of course, it's difficult, but you can with statistics actually do that. Then you could inform the experimentalist and optimize the experiments that you're doing. And so really, again, the conclusion from here is that because we now know and we are sure that small variations in the abundances of abundant molecules lead to large variations in the abundance of tracer molecules, you need to really embrace the complexity of chemical models. Without forgetting that you need to also, of course, look at the origin of these problems. And so we're really proposing a new era for astrochemistry, which employs techniques that the cosmologists and the extrasolar planets people have been using for quite some time. And this technique is really based on this statistical approach. And I have a minute, 2 minutes. I wanted to really just show you this work that was done quite a long time ago, but I thought that maybe this audience may be interested. So we were interested to look at star formation timescales as a function of redshift. These are the star formation timescales that we all know are true for the Milky Way conditions for low mass. And I don't have the time really to show you much, but I wanted to show you this, and then maybe if we can talk about it later if you're interested. Basically, we calculated all these timescales that are important, that they kind of match for the star to form. I mean, that's a key point, right? And for example, here we calculated them as a function of density. And as you can see, they all converge at about 10 to the 4 per centimeter cubed, but as it happened, is more or less the density of our molecular clouds in our own galaxies. But if you happen to have densities much lower or higher, these timescales start diverging and stars would not form. Same is true, of course, for metallicity. As it happens here, you are in the regime of solar metallicities, and these time scales calculated analytically, right? And of course, there might be, one might argue about the exact form, but more or less, I think we agree that those time scales are more or less correct for our Milky Way. And in fact, when you are in the solar metallicity environment, they kind of converge. And as you go down in metallicity, they start diverging. And same with cosmic reionization rate. This is more or less the cosmic rays for our galaxies. They converge. And the UV doesn't seem to affect too much these time scales. And so the question that we asked ourselves here, and then we never really, question is whether, you know, obviously there are some regimes whether the low mass star formation is inhibited. So does that mean a top-heavy IMF? I mean, I don't know. This is just a question. Okay, the point is it is true that there are some regimes, for example, in low metallicity systems or in active galaxies with solar metallicity, where the low mass star formation seems to be inhibited. And when we calculated the so-called CO ladder for this system, so here you have a model 2, so the model 2 is where low metallicity, and here is the solar metallicity. And so just pick a random curve. One is a low visualization, one is a high. You can see that you get similar CO rotational spectra. The distribution is flatter for this model compared to this, right? So really, this is just something we pondered about. But the bottom line is that high JCO observations, so this JCRS, I think now in the last few years, Herschel also has shown, coupled with dynamic and chemical models, there could be another way of giving clues about the initial mass function. And I'll stop here on time.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah.
Serena, yes.
Hi. You've showed that the in your different models, then the abundances vary by one or two order of magnitude. Do you know what's the uncertainty in the chemistry that can bring to the, because cosmic rays and dust, and these are really quite unknown in the high AV regions.
So then that's one of the reasons to do large parameter sets. So depends what you mean for uncertainty. Uncertainty in cosmic rays, as you say, are the initial parameters into the model. So what you do a large parameter search, and then you run the chemical models for the different parameters. Some are connected, of course, like metallicity and dust to gas ratio. We assume a scale. And then you look at the differences. And that's when you do these sensitivity studies, you look at the, you isolate parameter and you see what each parameter, what changes it can make to the chemistry. So that's an unknown, which is kind of known in the sense you can vary it and then look at the differences it makes in the abundances. The unknowns, which are more importantly worrying, are the unknowns in the rate coefficients of the thousands of chemical reactions that these chemical networks have. And the more chemical reactions you have in it, the more uncertainties you have, because these are often unknown, at least unknown if you look at the range of temperature. So there might be no more only at room temperature. But of course, if you reduce too much your network, it may work for maybe environments where the molecular content is not too much, maybe at the edges, the skin of PDRs, but as you go deep into the cloud, you can't reduce your network too much, because otherwise things like HC3N, you can't be confident that you model correctly. So that's really where the issue is. But that's where the statistical approach can actually help. Of course, not blindly.
Katsu.
So that So in addition to the parameters of cosmic rays, some radiations, maybe the dust surface reaction, the rate coefficient dust surface reaction is quite uncertain, I
completely
think. And so my question is that in addition to H2, so the H2 abundance is it's quite affected by dust surface reaction.
Yes.
But what other sort of chemical species are affected by dust surface reaction?
It's a very good question, a very debated one. So I think we can be certain that some species are mainly formed in the gas phase. For example, CO will form in the gas phase. It's true that then it depletes on the grains, and when it depletes on the grains, a lot of it remains in CO, but some will form other species, and we know, we kind of know with us, and there might be some debates, but methanol, for example, comes from the hydrogenation of CO on the grains. But that's as far as we know. I mean, there are some experiments. Again, we go back to the statistical approach. There are experiments, but compared to the number of reactions that we think may or may not work on the dust or on the gas phase, these experiments are you can count them, you know, in your hands, kind of. And so we need a way of prioritizing experiments. And of course, observations can help with that, because methanol, for example, for years, as it was thought that it could be formed in the gas phase, then there was an experiment showing that it couldn't form in the gas phase. So of course, people then concentrated in doing experiments on methanol. But you can see how slow the process is, right? I mean, you know, it could take years to just sort out one molecule. Even that, you sort it out within a certain parameter space. And I mean, some actually are still debating whether methanol can form on the grains, because there is a recent experiment that show that it's true that it forms from CO, but that when you're evaporating that methanol into the gas phase, it breaks, okay? So you're back to square one. So I think your question has a very long answer, or short, depending
not
on your
more
point
than 10
of view.
Minutes.
Or short. No, it can be short, meaning many, many species, some directly, like for those who are interested in complex molecules, you know, more than six atoms, most of you are not, then every reaction could be important. For other species, it's a bit less.
Methanol is minus of the molecule, I think. So that
for you, yes.
No,
like CO, I think on average, again, within those, I mean, you're seeing how small the variation in CO was when I was changing, you know, I was changing by a factor of four, even the oxygen, and a factor of two of the carbon, and yet at the end, the amount of CO that you were seeing in the gas phase was, you know, it was changing. But because we're talking about fractional abundances here, you know, when you are around 10 to minus 4, you know, you can change by 2 times 10 to minus 4, and observationally it doesn't make that much difference, right? So for those major molecules, I think I wouldn't worry too much. But of course, then some say it's H2 still quite, you know, the H2 formation on grains, as people are still studying it, because it's not studied in every environment yet.
Okay, so we have another question from Naoki.
Okay, can you answer to your initial question of contracting or expanding by your statistical approach?
I think at the moment the statistical approach that I've used is being on purely chemical models. Okay, so to answer the question, I think you need to have a better dynamics, even in my quotes. So even if I approximate, so one thing I didn't say, all those different modes of collapse, they were basically parameterized from the results of hydrodynamic simulation. So we got the results and then we fitted the curves. Some were better than others, of course. So you still need hydrodynamical models, but for our purpose, that was okay. So I think my positive answer is yes, of course, in the future, but that's it adds degrees of uncertainties or degrees in the parameter space that you need to cover with this statistical method, but I don't believe so, yeah.
Question from Fred.
Oh, just a quick question or a quick comment on your dynamical models.
Dynamical.
Yeah. Well, the simulations that you started with are a little bit, you know, that's what we did to start with, right? Sort of artificial, as you know, because you start and you make a very, very, very unstable core.
Yes.
And then you let it collapse. Now, nature's not going to make something that's so, so unstable and have it static and then start to collapse. What it's going to do is kind of collapse as it forms.
Yeah.
And what you see in the data, actually, is that the cores have what I like to call a head start velocity. But what that means is that the cores are actually not static things that are then at time zero collapse, but rather they kind of diffuse into their condensation state and smoothly transition into a collapse state. So my question is, one, you could add that to your dynamical thing, but given your experience and what you've done to date, how would that affect the different classes of things that you showed us?
So this was deliberate. And as I said at the beginning, there was no we were not trying to compare those to any observation. We were looking for large differences. So we were looking at a set of models which were truly collapsing fast, okay, even if unrealistic, and some instead were truly almost halted by magnetic pressure. The idea being is that if you could find appreciable differences between such extreme cases, okay, and so far, I guess, my answer is nigh. You know, if I was hoping for very large differences, and then one could investigate much more realistic models and be able to interpret and to see what differences you're finding. The difference we're finding in these extreme modes are not that big, right? So maybe they are detectable with interferometers for the abundance, for the species which are kind of low in abundance, but it's almost disappointing in a sense. So maybe if you want to see it from a positive way, it means that we chemists can get away with not having too much of details in the dynamics, because at the end of the day, the chemistry works out anyway. So you can see it both ways. But so yes, I'm aware that obviously the real models are not those. We deliberately took idealistic and extreme models.
It is time for one or two questions more, if there are any. Yeah, Ira.
I think it may be difficult, but if we are interested in a grain surface chemistry, what will be the key species that could constrain the, for example, grain property or something like that? Is it possible?
I one thing I didn't specify is that the surface reactions that we are considering in these models are in the ices. Okay, they're not on the core on the bare grains. So certainly not these models. I couldn't really tell you anything because the oxygen arrives so quickly. There's so much hydrogen, you form a water ice, and everything else is trapped inside the matrix of water. So the surface reactions that a lot of experiments do, and certainly the ones that we are considering our models, are inside the icy layers. So we can't really say much, fortunately for us, because it means we don't have to worry about the grain, the actual shape of things like that. But,
I have just a small curiosity. In the initial models, if you can put up the slide where you were showing the CO evolution as a function of time, there's always a final peak. The 2003 models, the 2003. Oh. Yeah, I know. I know they're old, but it's still an interesting physical issue.
Almost
here.
There.
Yeah. So
no, not this one. You're talking about this.
The CO, the next one.
Oh, okay. So these ones are now. I'm not old.
No. The CO.
Next.
The one that you had.
Next. Okay, so these are new. No, these are new models. They're not the 2003.
I thought they were 2003. Uh-huh. Anyway, so what is causing this peak and the rapid drop?
This is freeze out.
Yeah, but so.
It's this because the density.
So it's. Can you explain the physics?
Yeah. So basically, if you look at how the freeze out time scales is a function of density, as you know, and all these models of collapse, again, they might not be realistic, but this model class, including free fall, has a sharp, the density goes up like that, of course, so that's when you see the drop in CO. So you need to first make CO, which is how you do, you make it right towards the end, and then you really, if you zoom in, you'll see it's not as sharp, okay? But it's the sharp, it just freezes out. The AD model. So the AD model is the one where you have a magnetic support as well as ambipolar diffusion. So you have this this drift of the neutrons from the ions. And so here you also have non-thermal desorption. So you have some carbon given in its atomic form that comes up. Okay. So we're talking about a small difference here, but basically there's a balance between formation and but eventually freeze out dominates always.
Thank you.
We are recording.
Why you shoot to 10 to minus 10? Because you should have the cosmic rays that lift off at the level of 10 to minus
10 of what? Sorry.
The abundance of CO. You lose it. You don't have any mechanism.
You're right. I should plot up down to 10 to minus 12. That's what you're saying. No, what?
Usually it comes up. Do you have the cosmic rays that inject back?
Yeah, I do, but here in this particular model, they have a low flux of cosmic rays.
Ah, okay.
Yes, in this particular model, and then,
Fantastic. So let's thank Serena once again. And we continue more or less along the same lines with the next talk by Cecilia Ceccarelli and she will, the title of her talk will be Measuring the Cosmic Rays Flux by Observing Galactic and Extragalactic Models.